and turn to him now. Michael, I want you to ring Met and get a final weather forecast for this evening. Michael picked up the telephone from the bench in front of him and dialed the number of the weather information services at Jan Smuts Airport and listened to the pre-recorded announcement. Wind is still 290 degrees at 5 knots, he repeated. No change since this morning. Weather is settled, barometric pressure steady. Very well. Ramon picked up his red marker pencil and circled the position of the showgrounds on the large-scale aeronautical map. Then he marked in the wind direction. Okay, this will be your line of approach. About a mile upwind of the target. Try to maintain 1,000 feet above ground level. Open the gas valve as you pass the water towers. They are very prominently lit with navigational warning lights. Yes, Michael said. I flew over the area yesterday. The stadium will be floodlit, and there'll be a laser show. I can't possibly miss it. Well done, comrade. Ramon gave him one of his rare, irresistible smiles. Your preparations have been excellent. Michael looked down, and Ben interjected. I heard on 1 o'clock news that by noon more than 200,000 visitors had already passed through the showground turnstiles. It'll be more like 500,000 by the time Forster starts his official opening speech. What a blow we'll strike for freedom today. Forster's speech is scheduled to start at 7 p.m. Ramon picked up one of the advertising brochures issued by the show committee. He studied the opening program. But it might be a few minutes late. We must allow for that. He will probably talk for between 40 minutes and an hour. The military tattoo begins at 8 p.m. When will you take off? If we take off from here at 18:45 hours, Michael worked it out, it's about 48 minutes flying. I timed it yesterday. That'll get me over the target at 7:33. That would be about right, Ramon agreed. Forster should still be speaking. You will make 2 passes across the range, 1,000 feet above ground level, 1 mile upwind. After the second pass, you turn west and head directly for the Botswana border. What is your estimated flying time to the rendezvous with Rally Tabaka? 3 hours, 15 minutes, Michael replied. That gets me there approximately 11 o'clock tonight. By that time, any residual gas will have degraded. Rally Tabaka will light the airstrip with flares. As soon as you land, remove all the gas equipment and set fire to the plane. From there, it's up to Rally to get you out to Zambia and Tercio Base. Ramon studied their faces. Well, that's it, then. I know that we've gone over it 12 times, but are there any questions? The brothers shook their heads, and Ramon smiled wryly. Despite the difference in the colour of their skins and the texture of their hair, there was a strong resemblance. The revolution could never go forward without this kind of obedience and unquestioning faith, Ramon thought, and he felt an uncustomed envy of such uncomplicated trust. Let them believe that this single act would change the world and herald the perfect dawn of universal socialism and brotherly love. Ramon knew that nothing was so simple. He envied them their faith, but he wondered if they truly had the stomach to live through the stark reality of the slaughter of 500,000 lambs and the red terror which must follow the successful onslaught of the revolution. Sublime belief in the ultimate rightness of their action might permit them to turn the valve on a pair of innocent-looking steel bottles, but could they endure the reality of 500,000 corpses twisted and contorted in piles of hideous death, he wondered. Only the steel men survived. These two were not of that temper. The Red Terror would claim them, as it did all weaklings. After tonight, their usefulness would be reduced. They would be expendable. He touched Michael's shoulder gently. He knew that Michael liked to be touched by another man. He let the touch become a caress. You have done wonderfully well. Now you must eat and rest. I will leave you before you take off this evening. I salute you both. They walked in a group to the door in the rear of the shed. But before they reached it, Michael stopped. I want to look at Ben's installation of the bottles and go over my own checks, he said diffidently. I want to be absolutely certain. You are right to want everything perfect, comrade, Ramon agreed. We'll have something for you to eat when you come up to the house. They watched him climb into the cockpit of the Centurion and begin checking the instruments before they walk together to the door. Ramon threw open the small back door in the rear wall of the hangar, and as he and Ben stepped through into the sunlight together, Sean Courtney was crouched against the side wall on their left-hand side, staring at them. Only 6 feet separated Ramon and Sean, and their mutual recognition was instantaneous. Sean reached under his coat and plucked out the big Magnum revolver. The double-action pull on the trigger delayed the shot a fleeting part of a second, and Ramon seized Ben Africa's arm and pulled him forward between them. With a muzzle flash that was bright even in the sunlight, Sean's shot crashed into Ben's body. The hollow-point bullet struck him on the tip of the left elbow and mushroomed instantly. It ploughed through his arm and went into his flank. The entry wound into his body was the size of an egg cup. The bullet struck his last rib and began to break up. Fragments were deflected into his lung. Others tore through his entrails. A splinter of the copper jacket cut between the vertebrae of the spine and half-severed his spinal cord. Ben was flung sideways by the impact, and he slid down the wall, leaving a bright smear of his blood across the rusty corrugated iron. Ramon Machado ducked back into the hangar before Sean could bring the revolver down from the head-high recoil. He kicked the door closed behind him and snatched the Tukarev automatic from his shoulder holster. He snapped 2 quick shots through the thin wall, aiming for where he judged Sean was standing. Sean had anticipated this and had dropped flat and flipped over twice. He estimated Ramon's stance from the sound of the shots and the angle of the bullets cutting through the corrugated iron wall. He fired double-handed, and the heavy bullet punched a hole through the wall and missed Ramon's head by a foot. Ramon ducked behind a drum of avgas and shouted across the hangar at Michael as he sat at the controls of the aircraft, "Start up!" Michael had been frozen with shock in the pilot's seat of the Centurion, but at Ramon's order he recovered and flipped on both master switches and both magnetos and turned the key. The Centurion's engine fired and caught. He pushed the throttle open, and she roared eagerly and strained against the wheel brakes. "Get her rolling!" Ramon shouted, and fired 2 more shots through the wall at random. The Centurion moved forward towards the open hangar door, gathering speed swiftly, and Ramon raced after her, ducked under the wing and jerked open the passenger door. "Oh, where's Ben?" Michael shouted at him as he scrambled into the seat. "Ben is finished," Ramon shouted back. "Keep going!" "What do you mean, finished?" Michael twisted in the seat and closed the throttle. "We can't leave him!" "Ben is dead, man," Ramon caught his hand on the throttle. "Ben has been shot. He's finished. We have to get out of here."
"Ben?"
"Keep her going." Michael pushed the throttle open once again and swung the Centurion onto the runway. His face was twisted with grief. "Ben," he whispered, and let the speed build up until the Centurion was taxiing tail up along the strip. They reached the end, and he used brake and engine to swing her around, facing back down the runway into the wind. "The engine is cold," he said. "She hasn't had a chance to warm up." "We've got to chance it," Ramon told him. "The police are going to be swarming in. They're on to us. Somehow they've tumbled to it."
"Ben?"
"Forget about Ben," Ramon snapped. "Get us into the air." "Where are we going?"
"Botswana?"
Michael still hesitated. "Yes," Ramon told him. "But first we are going to finish this operation. Head for the showgrounds."
But you say the police are onto us," Michael protested.
"Well, how can they stop us now? It will take an hour to get an Air Force Impala into the air. Go on, man, go!" Michael pushed the pitch fully fine and opened the throttle wide. The Centurion bounded down the strip. As the speed built up, they saw a figure run out from behind the hangar. Michael recognized his brother.
"Sean!" he exclaimed.
"Keep going," Ramon told him. Sean dropped on 1 knee at the verge of the runway, and as the Centurion raced towards him, he thrust both arms towards it in the classic double-handled grip and fired 3 deliberate shots. Each time the heavy recoil threw the muzzle of the revolver towards the sky. The last shot struck the windscreen, and they both ducked instinctively. It left a silver cobweb in the perspex pane, and then Michael rotated the Centurion's nose, and they skimmed over the boundary fence
and bore up into the clear blue high-felt sky. At 200 feet, the cold motor stuttered and coughed. Then it caught again and ran smoothly.
"Head for the showgrounds," Ramon repeated. "We won't get Forster, but it's still a good target. There are 200,000 of them."
Michael levelled out at 1,000 feet and turned onto his track. As the Centurion soared overhead, Sean emptied the revolver, blazing up at its belly. He saw no sign of his bullet striking, and the landing wheels of the Centurion retracted as she rose unharmed into the sky. Sean jumped to his feet and sprinted into the hangar. He saw the telephone on the workbench. Thank God! He ran to the bench and snatched it up. As he dialed the Capricorn number, he noticed the open map under his hands and the Rand Easter Show brochure. The red-marked notations on the map ringed the location of the showgrounds, and a broad arrow indicated the wind direction and speed. The operator on the switchboard answered on the third ring.
"Capricorn Chemical Industries, good day. How may I help you?"
"Get me Mr. Gary Courtney in the boardroom. I'm his brother. This is an emergency."
"He is expecting your call. You're going straight through."
As he waited, Sean glanced quickly around the hangar. He saw the safety suits hanging on the wall beside the door.
"Is that you, Sean?" Gary's voice was strained.
"Yes, it's me. I'm at Firgrove. It's as bad as we feared. Michael and Ben and the Fox. The target is the showgrounds."
"Did you stop them, Sean?"
"No. Michael and the Fox are airborne. They took off 2 minutes ago. They're almost certainly heading for the showgrounds."
"Are you sure, Sean?"
"Of course I'm bloody sure. I'm in Mickey's hangar, and I'm looking at a map right now. The showgrounds are marked, and the wind speed and direction. There are 2 smoke-proof suits hanging on the wall. They didn't have any chance to get into them. I'll warn the police, the Air Force."
"Now, don't be a prick, Gary. It will take an order from the Chief of the Defence Force and the Minister before they'll send up a fighter or a helicopter gunship. That could take a month of Sundays. By then, 200,000 people will be dead."
"Well, what must we do, Sean?" At last the administrator deferred to the man of action.
"Take the Queen Air," Sean told him. "She's faster and bigger and more powerful than the little Centurion. You have to intercept them and force them down before they reach the show."
"Describe Mickey's Centurion," Gary ordered crisply. "Blue on top, white belly. Her markings are ZSRRW, Romeo Romeo Whiskey. You know the location of Firgrove and their course to reach the show."
"Right, I'm on my way," said Gary, and the connection clicked and went dead.
Sean picked up the Smith & Wesson from the bench top, where he had dropped it, and spilled the empty cases from the chambers. From his pocket he pulled the box of ammunition and reloaded swiftly. He ran back to the door, and with the revolver held ready, he stood clear and kicked it open. Immediately he dropped into a gunfighter's crouch and aimed through the doorway. Ben had dragged his paralysed legs only a few yards before he collapsed. He lay in a huddle at the foot of one of the peach trees. He was bleeding copiously. Bright arterial blood had soaked his shirt and the tops of his trousers. His left arm hung by a tatter of mangled flesh. The shattered bone was spiked through the meat like a skewer. Sean straightened up and safed the Smith & Wesson. He walked through the door and stood looking down at Ben. Ben was still alive. He rolled over painfully to look up at Sean. His eyes were brown as burnt sugar, and filled with a dreadful anguish.
They got away, didn't they?" he whispered. "They will succeed. You cannot stop us. The future belongs to us."
Isabella came running through the trees. She saw Sean and swerved towards him.
"I told you to keep out of the way," he growled at her. "Why can't you ever do as you're told?"
She saw Ben lying at his feet and stopped short.
"It's Ben."
"Oh, God, what have you done to him?"
She started forward again and dropped to her knees beside the prostrate body. Carefully she lifted Ben's head into her lap. But the movement tore something in his injured lung, and he began to cough. A mouthful of blood spilled between his open lips and poured from his chin.
"Oh, God, Sean, you've killed him," Isabella sobbed.
"I hope so," Sean said softly. "With all my heart, I hope so."
Sean. He's your brother.
No, said Sean. He's not my brother. He's just a lump of shit.